Welcome to Ken and Frank Live Show. Today we go historical, not hysterical.
Wow.
Welcome back for another day of Candid Frank Live, and the most important story of the day is around the league, the cheerleader teams are being settled down. That's right. The cheer squads are almost set, so we're almost ready for the Canadian Football League season. That's what really matters, is that the cheerleaders are all picked out. Okay, no kidding aside. Let's move on to some other stuff, of course. And, well, maybe we'll save that one for later. I'll save that one. That one I'll save for later. Yeah, that one's for later. That one's for later. This one here, no, we won't do that one now. Let's see. What do we got? What else we got here? Yeah. Looks like the Winnipeg Blue Bombers are bringing in some new quarterbacks. That's an important thing for them to do. Yep. And it appears... There we go. There's something we can talk about. This is the one we started talking about last week. Now, let's not talk about this too loudly. But right now it appears that all the teams are under the salary cap before the season starts. You know that dangerous thing where that hurts salary caps more than anything is our injuries? Well, I'm finding it hard to believe that Saskatchewan is under the salary cap. But, hey, if the commish says it's so, I ain't going to doubt him for a second. Now, also, the Argos made a trade, and they traded for non-import linebacker Kwasi Antwi with the Calgary Stampeders. Jim Barker made that trade. And I bet you made that trade under duress. And the duress that he was under was under the big fight yesterday that Chad Owens was in. That's right. It comes out now after the fight and after Owens is okay and he's not hurt. It comes out that Barker was very concerned. And as well he should be. And he clearly noted, as we said on this show a few weeks ago, that if the Argos could have made him not do it, they would have. But they can't. It's not in their contract. They don't have the ability to not tell a player what to do during the regular season. And the investment that the CFL makes in players, while it may not be as big as other leagues, in particular the NFL, it's the investment in that talent that Chad Owens brings to the field. After all, he was the MVP of the league last year. So I'm sure there was a lot of sweating going on at the Argo offices. Now, if he would have gone down, it would have been interesting to see how that played out. We're going to take a short break right now, and when we come back from our break, we're going to have Paul Woods on. Paul Woods is writing a book called Bouncing Back. It's about the 81-83 Argos, 81-83 Argos. The 83 Argos were the first Argo team to win a Grey Cup in a very long time, and they came in the early 80s, also were the vestiges of that team, at least the beginnings of that team, were the worst team in Argo history. So they had the best and the worst for that lineup, as you heard Dan Ferrone tell us a few months ago. If you want to be heard, disagreed with, or just plain shot down, come on, be brave. Call the Candid Frank Live Show, a.k.a. the CFL Show. You already hit the link to bring up the player, and you hit the play button so you can hear us. Now hit that little Skype button on that Candid Live player sitting there, like your pet wanting a snack, so to connect with us and tell us your thoughts. Hit that little tiny, cute, and tempting Skype button, right? Now, do it! Or call 714-242-5250. That's 714-242-5250. A little introduction music for our friend Paul Woods. Welcome to the show, Paul. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Frank. Thanks. How are you?
Playing kids with the music, buddy. Okay, now, here we are. We're back again after a few weeks. And you've been doing the circuit. I've seen you've been on some other shows, and you're putting out the good word that your book is coming out. From time to time, we will be sort of highlighting your book in the upcoming months. Not on a regular basis, but every few weeks you're going to come in and you're going to give us a flavor on the book, correct?
Yeah, or on an irregular basis, you might say.
Yeah, regardless, there are going to be sentences, and each of those sentences have X amount of letters in them. So they're not all the same. The intention and the message has a theme, and the theme is, from the years 1981 to 83, there was a big change in the Toronto Argonauts. What began in 81 was probably the worst team they've had in a long time. And it culminated after a few years of building and a little good drafting and players maturing. It peaked in 83 where the Argos won their first Grey Cup in many years. And your book takes that low point to that high point, correct?
That's exactly right, Frank.
What part of the journey do you want to start with tonight? Do you want to start at the beginning or wherever you choose, my friend?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about sort of how the book came about, maybe to start with, actually. And I was a fan, like a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, were fans back then, and you know, probably fans through the bad times of the late 70s and into the early 80s, and then obviously for the fun years of 82 and 83, and of course, since then. And, I always had a soft spot in my heart for the 83 Argonauts, and I always thought that that was a very special team, and one that I remember very fondly. You know, we've had lots of great Argo teams since then, but that one had a particular appeal to me, at least. And I always kind of thought, you know, there were some stories that probably had never come out about then, and what happened, and how it all came about, and sort of had in the back of my mind, it would be lovely to sort of explore that someday and find out what happened. And so, about a year ago, I'd essentially retired from work, or I guess you could say semi-retired, and I had a little more time on my hands than I had in the past, and was out for a bike ride one day, and I just sort of got the brainwave, you know, man, I'd love to read about those Argonauts of 83 and 81 and 82 for that matter, and I don't know if anybody else is going to write the book. Maybe I should do it. So I started down this path. I started reaching out to people and asking them, can I interview you? I want to write this book? And got some great response from guys associated with the team. Pretty well everybody I've contacted has been totally on board, wanting to talk, wanting to remember. A lot of them say it was that 83 team was the greatest team they ever played on, or the most fun they ever had. And so I've been on this journey for the last year. I've been out there going around to different cities and towns and interviewing people and doing some of it on the phone and really finding out the stories behind the stories, the things that we all saw, what was going on in the players' minds when things were happening, how did they see things, what things did we never hear about that fans would be interested in hearing about. And now I'm in the process of trying to put it all together, and I've got gobs and gobs of material, more than I can use in the book, actually. It's a nice problem to have, but it makes it a challenge, and I'm in the process now of doing the final writing to get the book out later this summer.
And it included a lot of really good players, starting with Terry Greer and Condridge Holloway. That team that eventually won surprised many, including the Argo fans, I think only because before that, the team seemed to always snatch defeat from the hands of victory.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of those guys that were there in 83 when they won it all were also there in 81 when they had their most terrible season ever. So you're right. I mean, if you'd asked a lot of Argo fans in 81, do you think these guys that we have right now are going to win the championship 2 years from now? I don't know if a lot of people would have thought that they would. And as it turned out, a lot of the guys that were there in 83 were there in 81.
And a lot of those players were not, you know, it never was a problem for the Argos to have talented players. But for some reason, they couldn't make that last little jump over that last hurdle. What was different about this, you know, having sunk so low, what made this team so successful and eventually winning the Grey Cup?
Well, that's a great question, and, you know, there's probably a whole lot of reasons. A lot of factors had to come together for that to happen. One of them you alluded to earlier, you talked about the draft choices. I mean, they drafted incredibly well over a three-year span. They did a great job. Willie Wood, who was the coach in 80 and 81 and was long gone by the time they won the Grey Cup in 83, but Willie did one thing that really was remarkable. He had the foresight to say, we've got to improve the Canadian talent on this team, and he started making a lot of trades that picked up draft choices. They stockpiled picks in 82 and 83, and then when Willie was gone by 82 he was gone. Ralph Sazio was the president, Bob Abilovich was the head coach, and those guys cashed those draft choices in very smartly. They over a 3 year span. I think I'd have to look at the numbers, but my recollection from the research I've been doing is that there were about 12 non-import players who came in over that three-year span who became very strong contributors to the team, either as starters or as very important special teams players. But many of them started, and if you look at their roster in 1980, I think there was one Canadian player still there in 83. That was Paul Pearson. Steve Ackroyd was also there. So the two of them were the only two Canadians that were there from 1980 through 83, and which tells you they completely turned over the non-import roster. So that was one of the factors. There were many, though. I mean, obviously, you know, the bringing in Bob Abilovich as a head coach was a very smart move. Bob was the right fit at the right time for the Argonauts. You mentioned they'd have lots of star players, and they couldn't seem to turn it into wins. Some of that was coaching. Some of that was the wrong guys as the coaches. Bob Abilovich wasn't the wrong guy. Bob Abilovich was exactly the right guy. Another huge factor, though, and this is one place where you really can see a difference between the Argonauts of 82 and 83 and the Argonauts of all through the 70s after Joe Theismann left, was a quarterback. You
Absolutely.
Talked about Condridge Holloway was the best quarterback in the history of the Argonauts, certainly in the modern-day history of the Argonauts. I mean, I can't speak to, you know, Joe Kroll and guys of the 50s because I didn't see them. But for both ability and leadership in particular, and, of course, longevity because he was there for six seasons, Condridge was the man. And he was there in 81. And he, you know, he suffered through that terrible season. He got sacked a million times. And he never got down. The guys tell me, you know, almost to a man, they talk about how he kept their spirits up when they were going 2-14. He never quit. He never got down on guys. And they all wanted to take a bullet for Condridge Holloway. And so when they got a better offense the following year with Bob Abilovich and Mouse Davis and Condridge Holloway running the offense, the guys were determined that they were going to perform for him.
And they did. And the crowd of 60,000 people on Bay Street watching the Grey Cup go by after, I guess, what, a 31-year absence? They
yep.
hadn't won the Grey Cup in some 31 years, which,
yeah,
you know,
time.
It sounds like a long time, but then if you're a Leaf fan, that's not that long after all. But I digress. I'm sorry. But in
well,
Argonaut,
just,
in Argonaut terms,
that
that's,
second,
short,
no,
that's
Frank,
a long time.
I was just going to say, you know, I hear your point about the Leafs, and I'm not here to take a shot at the Leafs, but the one thing that I think is worth noting is that, you know, the Leafs have gone, what's it now, 46 years or something, but that's in a league that now has 30 teams and for most of that time had at least 12 or 16 or 21 teams, and actually for many years, I think for close to a decade or more. It's been a 30-team league. So winning the Stanley Cup is something that, you know, only one in 30 teams does. The Argonauts didn't get to the Grey Cup. You know, they got the Grey Cup one time in 31 years in a league in which only four teams in the East Division were there. I mean, they had theoretically a one in four chance every year of getting to the Grey Cup, and they got there once in 30 years.
So, yeah, so they were a sad sack team. You know, we all remember Leo Cahill. We all remember Leon McQuay. You know, we remember the bad luck the Argos had, too, on the way. And they were snake-bitten. In fact, they could be compared to the Boston Red Sox in baseball in as far as loyalty from the fans and failure by the team over a prolonged and protracted period.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good analogy. Although and I don't know enough about the Red Sox fan base to really know kind of what their mentality was through that long, long period of not winning. But the one thing I will say about the Argo fans back in the late 70s and into 80, 81 is that while they were certainly, you know, they certainly had fantastic attendance back then, and they were a big, big deal in the Toronto sporting scene. They were up there on a par with the Leafs pretty well. I never had the sense when I started going to Argo games that the fans, they had the same kind of burning desire for them to win that I did. I often felt that the fans kind of almost expected them to lose, and maybe almost even in a kind of a weird, perverse way, almost enjoyed them losing, and maybe because of the bizarre ways that they would lose, that sort of thing.
No, I think you're 100% right about that. You know, the cat call, and it was a cat call to start. The Argo chant, we mentioned this before you were on, that was basically, you know, Argos. It's like the haunting of the team, and that's, you know, confirming that the team's haunted and they can't win. And the fans, yes, I think they rolled with the punches. They're much like the fans are a lot like as well the Chicago Cub fans. I mean, there are teams in sports that lose but don't lose the affection of their fans. And I don't think, you know, I don't think the Argos lost the affection of their fans. In the whole time, they hadn't won the Grey Cup in those 31 years. They had full houses, or they had at least, they had great crowds, better crowds than, you know, than many.
Oh, no question. They were you know, up there in one of the top three teams in attendance back in the late 70s, along with Montreal and Edmonton, which the three teams with the largest stadiums, of course. But the Argos were, you know, when Exhibition Stadium was expanded, they were drawing consistently 48,000-49,000 back then. But, you know, the one thing that was interesting about when you talk about the fan base, and Conrad Holloway told me that, because he played six seasons with the Ottawa Rough Riders before coming to Toronto, and he said to me, you know, when I was with Ottawa, we thought it was almost like a home game for us. We knew that if we could just get one touchdown early, the fans would turn on the Argos, and then we'd be almost like playing at home. And I think there was some truth to that. I used to be mad because I'd go to those games, and you know, Zen and Andrew Sisson was our kicker at the time, and he would come on to kick a field goal, and it felt like the fans were almost hoping he would miss. There was just something weird about the mentality. Like we like the fact that our boys always find creative ways to lose, and it drove me nuts at times. I felt like, you know, he's not going to make that field goal if he's getting this kind of a vibe out of the stands. And yeah, it was great from a business standpoint, having 49,000 fans there. The revenues must have been huge. They would have been probably the big money team in the league, and so on. But I bet the players weren't really feeling the love, you know. And when they got good in '82, and they actually got not only good but exciting, and the players really did feel the love, boy, it was noticeable. I mean, there were some games in that 82 season in particular where the fans were just bonkers. They were loving it so much. They not only are we winning, but we're exciting.
And you know, that's kind of, I think, more or less a disease of the Toronto sports fans. I think we have a reputation for sitting on our hands and have a reputation for not supporting our team in a manner that they do in other cities.
Yeah, I think that's true for sure. And I don't know that it's only Toronto. I think it's a little bit of the Canadian mentality to some extent. I mean, you know, I think that they're certainly the rowdier in Montreal at Alouettes games. Part of that might be the stadium that they play in now. I think the Canadiens fans are rowdier than Leafs fans. Part of that might be the fact that there's more corporate buyers at the ACC than there are at the Bell Centre. But I think, you know, I've seen a lot of games in Calgary and Edmonton and Vancouver, and I don't think they're as loud there as they are in Seattle or Oakland or Houston, places like that. I think it's a bit of a Canadian thing, but it's definitely a Toronto thing for sure.
Yeah, well, you know what, though? The nice thing about the Argos back then is that the Argos had such fame, and they really were all there was in the summer. They truly were. The Blue Jays cut into that severely, without a doubt. They cut into that severely. The hockey season at the time, I think, began in October, November. I think the first games were in November back then. And the season was over by the beginning of April, middle of April, no later than the end of April. Where now we have hockey going on till June. The baseball starts in April. And you have the Argos starting in June, July. And it becomes the more important part of the season of baseball. And everybody's suffering from the fans, I mean. The sports fans are suffering from, you know, the Stanley Cup hangover. And I think it's been really tough since the early 80s and since the 70s, since the Jays came in. Since hockey kept on dragging on more and more, you know, there's a lot of people that are spending a lot of sports dollars in ways that they weren't spending back in before the Jays came here and before hockey went so late in the year. And it's tough.
Sure.
It's tough, you know, and you know, looking back at the way things were then historically, the fans, it was football in the summer. It was football, and it meant a lot to all the fans here. It is what we had to do. I mean, I think you mentioned before they couldn't play games on Sundays. They had to play them on Saturdays because of the Sunday rule, the Lord's Day Act. So, you know, it was a different time. As a team, the drafts worked really well, you know, in 81. Let's concentrate a little bit on how bad they were in 81. Do you mind?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. That's good.
Okay, let's concentrate how bad they were in 81. What made them so bad? They had Holloway. They had Cedric Minter, who was not a penny ante running back. He was a quality running back.
Yeah, they actually had a very good offense, and a very good offensive players and talent in 81. Holloway, Cedric Minter, Terry Greer, Paul Pearson were all starters, although Greer did get hurt early in that season. I think he got hurt in the fifth game. Dave Newman, who many fans will remember, was a great rookie in 1980. In fact, he was the East Division Rookie of the Year in 1980. He had 10 touchdown receptions and was, I think, second on the Argos in overall receiving behind Bob Gaddis in 80. He got hurt as well early in the year. So they lost their two key receivers, which didn't help. But they had a lot of weird things happen to them that year, Frank. I mean, they lost the first three games by a total of 5 points. They lost by 1 point in the season opener, they lost by 1 point a week later, and then they lost by 3 points. And all three of those games they very easily could have won, arguably should have won two of them. The first game they didn't really play very well, and yeah, they only lost by one, but they weren't very impressive. Holloway had a couple of interceptions in his first game as an Argo and came out in the papers afterwards saying, "I stunk." You know, as a typical leader of Convert Holloway, he put it all on his own shoulders. But game two, they were up by 20 points at halftime in Montreal, and then they managed to fritter away the lead, and the Alouettes came back and won by a point. Game three, they come home and play BC, and they're you know, it's a close game. They're within 3 points. They're driving for the winning touchdown. Holloway had his first really great game. He'd thrown four touchdown passes. And he's leading them down the field, and it's looking like he's going to throw the winning touchdown pass here, and we're going to win this game and get going. And in a way that looked like that they had the talent, that they, if they'd won that game, they could have gone and had a pretty impressive season. And unfortunately, he overthrew a receiver. He had an open man at the end zone at the goal line, and he overthrew him, threw a pick in the end zone, got incredibly mad, smashed his helmet to the ground. It burst into a whole thousand pieces, and all of a sudden they're 0-3, despite having surrendered five more points than their opponents. And so that was a very strange start to the year. And then game four was the game where it just went, everything went south. They went to Hamilton. Somebody apparently forgot to order the buses. Willie Wood did not like the dressing room at Ivor Wynne Stadium. It's a small, I don't know if you've ever been in the visitor's dressing room there, but it's a small, cramped room. And for whatever reason, he hated that room. And he said, we're going to dress at Exhibition Stadium and take buses and go straight onto the field. Which I guess sounds all fine in theory, but somebody better have a bus there. And the players are all hanging around outside Exhibition Stadium waiting for the bus to get there, and it doesn't show up. And finally, Willie says to Tom Hudspeth, the general manager, Tom, what time did you order the buses for? And Tommy Hudspeth says to Willie, I thought you ordered the buses. And they both go running inside. And then, sometime afterwards, a couple of rickety old school buses show up. They get stuck in traffic. They get stuck in traffic in Oakville. And they arrive at Ivor Wynne Stadium literally about the time the game was supposed to start. Freddie Dunbar, the trainer, is in, taping up guys in the bus. And they get off the bus, and the ref says, you got 5 minutes to warm up, Argos, we're starting the game. So there's no stretching time, no warm-up time. And Tommy Clements was playing quarterback for Hamilton, and he came out and just started abusing the Argo defensive backs who were not stretched. It was 7-0 in no time. It's 14-0 in no time. Then it's 21-0. And they go on to lose the game by 44 points. So the first three games they lose by 5, the fourth they lose by 44. And it was just one of those weird years, like a lot of weird, strange things happened. The talent on the defense was definitely lacking. They if you look at their roster between 81 and 82, they turned over most of the defensive personnel. I think there were only three guys back between 81 and 82 on defense, and a couple of those guys were backups. But their offense was pretty much the same. They in 81, 82, they had Holloway, they had Minter, they had Greer, they had Dave Newman, they had Paul Pearson. I think at least three of the offensive linemen who started in 81 were still starting in 82, including a couple of guys who were rookies in 81, Ferroni and Trifo. And, they had talent on the offensive side of the ball. I talked to Willie Wood Jr., Willie Wood's son, who was a kid at the time, and he spent the entire summer, both of 80 and 81, at Exhibition Stadium every day. He's a 10-year-old, 11-year-old kid. Dad would bring him down to the stadium to hang around all day while they were in practice, and he got to know the players pretty well. He followed things. He became himself a coach later on and knows a lot about football. And he said to me, if we'd had Mouse Davis as our offensive coach in 81, we would have won the Grey Cup in 81. And there's some truth to that. I mean, their defense may not have been strong enough, and the Eskimos were very strong in 81, obviously, but they had offensive talent there, and it was just one of those years where everything that could go wrong went wrong.
And it did.
Oh, yeah, it did. I mean, they went from 0-4 after the Hamilton game, then another close loss. Then they bring in Ralph Fazio as president after week five.
And let's stop right there. Let's take a break right there. We'll go to a couple of commercials, and then we'll come back. Ralph Fazio comes in, and we'll talk about the changes that Ralph Fazio made with the Toronto Argonauts that may have led to their winning the Grey Cup in 1983.
The following is a message from the 2012 Grey Cup champions, your Toronto Argonauts. If you didn't hear your voice, there's still time to be a part of next year's crowd. It's okay to pile on. Get your 2013 season tickets today. Call 416-341-ARGO or go to argonauts.ca.
Argo!
Bullying, not a good idea. Do your part.
What is your football fantasy? I know what mine is. What is your football fantasy? Winnipeg fans can let you know one way or the other how things are going and what their opinions are. We understand that it's the fans that are the lifeblood of this league. It's great to play in an area with a community that cares very much. I tell you, Barbados has to be one of the most pristine environments I've ever seen. They're some of the nicest beaches I've experienced in my life, and the people here are extremely accommodating and friendly. It's interesting to see, you know, the different dynamics and the personality when you take the pads and the helmets off. You really get to know the guys, from surfing with them to grabbing some rum punch later on in the evening or going on a safari jungle tour.
Hey.
I'm looking forward to teaming up with some great fans from Winnipeg. I guarantee you'll have a good time.
That's right. You can join the CFLPA Fantasy Camp. All you have to do is go to the CFLPA website, and they will give you a hint on how to join. That is, play football with CFL players. Then, you know, go out and relax and chill with CFL players. So you get to have, the game experience and the social experience. I'm sure there's a few of you out there that wouldn't mind getting involved in that. Check it out at cflpa.ca. And that is, of course, the Players Association for the Canadian Football League Players. All right, we left ourselves at Ralph Cesio entering the picture. And I think many will agree that Ralph Cesio, the Ticat trader, the great GM, was the reason why the Argos made the turnaround. He made some really intelligent decisions, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it wasn't perfect. He made his first, oddly enough, his first big move with the Argos was to bring in a quarterback named Dan Minucci. Dan had been cut by the Buffalo Bills, and Cesio brought him in and did a pretty splashy press conference where he said he's another Tom Clements. He reminds me of Tom Clements. And Dan Minucci turned out to not remind anyone of Tom Clements. So he didn't get off to the greatest start, but he absolutely made some key moves. I mean, obviously his first and arguably his most important one was the choice of Bob Obilovich as head coach after the 81 season. He let Willie Wood go after 10 games in 81, put Tommy Hudspeth in the role for the last six, and then brought in a new coach. And he interviewed apparently at least a dozen guys. There were all kinds of big names mentioned that were going to be coming to the Argos, including Ara Parsegian, who'd been with Notre Dame, and three or four guys that had been NFL head coaches. And on December 30th, I believe it was, 1981, Ralph, the Argos, called a news conference where he introduced Bob Obilovich. And the Toronto Star headline told it all. Bob who? Bob Obilovich was a guy who was not on anybody's radar. Even rabid CFL fans had not heard of the man. I mean, he was a defensive backfield coach with the Ottawa Rough Riders, and I guess defensive coordinator, but assistant coaches were not really well-known around the league at the time, and Bob was not a well-known guy. And he turned out to be the right guy for the Toronto Argonauts to lead them to Grey Cup 2 years later. So that was Cesio's, his most important move. He did some other things. He did some symbolic things. I mean, actually, aside from the ill-fated recruiting of Dan Minucci, an early move that he made was he cleaned up some of the craziness going on around the Argonauts. He said it's a country club. His son told me a great story that his son told me a couple of great stories. Mark Cesio grew up as a huge Tiger Cats fan, as you can imagine. I mean, Ralph was with the Tiger Cats for 30 years. He was a player. He was an assistant coach. He was a head coach. He was the general manager. He was the president. He was everything. He was Mr. Tiger Cat. And so his kids, Mark and Peggy, grew up as Tiger Cat fans. And Mark Cesio happened to be up on a fishing trip somewhere up in northern Ontario when his dad moved to the Argonauts. And Mark hadn't heard anything about it. There were no cell phones back then. And he comes back from his fishing trip, and his dad says, you better sit down. I've gone to the Argos. And Mark says, no friggin' way. What are you talking about? He had to show him the newspaper to prove it to him. So that was pretty funny. But what happened was that a few days after taking over, when by this time Mark is back in southern Ontario, and Ralph brings his son Mark over to Exhibition Stadium to the offices of the Argonauts, because he wanted to, you know, get his office organized and, you know, make sure he knew where everything was and so on. And he opens up the fridge, and it's full of beer. And Ralph says, what's this beer? And they say, well, we're owned by Carling O'Keefe, and every Friday they deliver a bunch of beer for us. And he says, that's not happening anymore. He says, Mark, do you want beer? Do you want a couple of cases of beer? Take that beer out of here. And that was the end of the beer delivery from Carling O'Keefe. He felt that the Argos were not a football organization, it was a country club, that everybody was living high off the hog and there was no accountability. The front office was too big. He trimmed the front office back hugely, arguably, I would say, too much. I mean, they didn't really do the kind of marketing that they needed to do once Ralph got there. And Ralph's opinion essentially was, you build a winner, they will come. Well, the proof of the opposite had been the last 6 years, when the Argonauts drew the biggest crowds of their history when they weren't a winner. So you couldn't just assume that they suddenly win the Grey Cup, the crowds are going to get bigger. And sadly, in reality, the crowds went down after they won the Grey Cup. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that there were no staff in the front office, there was no real marketing department per se, and so on. So he made some mistakes, but from a football standpoint, you know, the hiring of Obilovich, the approval of Mouse Davis as Obilovich's offensive coordinator, the trade to bring in Joe Barnes, giving the Argos two legitimate number one quarterbacks, and even though Holloway was the primary starter in 82 and 83, Barnes played a lot in 83, and of course Barnes came off the bench and led them to the Grey Cup in 83, so, you know, that was a genius move. So Ralph did a lot of those things. And as I said earlier, he and Obilovich, they had some draft choices that were handed to them by Willie Wood, and they used those draft picks very effectively.
Now, the team later on in that season in 81, we talked about Game 4 when the team, before, and then went for Game 5 to play Ottawa. Oh, no, sorry, was it Hamilton where the bus happened, the bus fiasco?
Yeah, that was Hamilton Game 4. Then they had a close loss at home in Game 5, and then they went to Ottawa Game 6 the day after Ralph was hired, and they just had a terrible performance. He'd been the president of the team for, I guess, about 30 hours when he watched that just horrendous performance.
The point I was going to make is that in those days, the fans were a lot closer to the players than they are today. If I remember correctly, the only thing between the players and the fans was that chain link fence where the buses pulled into, if I remember correctly.
At
Exhibition Stadium. At Exhibition Stadium. There was a chain link fence. I remember leaning against that fence, and you could call the Argo players over that were waiting for the bus to leave, and they'd come over and talk to you. The players were far more accessible, not because the players don't want to be today, but because there's a thin double blue line between the fans and the players. Could that be part of it as well, that the popularity of the team began to diminish when the contact between the players and the team? I mean, during the game, my example of it is. The mentality changed a little bit. This year when the Argonauts won the Grey Cup, they didn't take the Grey Cup. Here they are, they're playing in their home stadium, and they didn't bring it to the sidelines, you know, to all the sidelines, encircling the field, which I think was something that they missed doing. That's something that could have been done. I don't think today there is as big a connection between the players and the fans, and I believe it's for whatever reason, you'll have to tell me, because I don't know why that gap begins. We have opportunities here with the people I know to meet some of the players. But I mean just the regular fans after the game. The players, for the most part, disappear. You know, I hear that fans can go onto the field and meet the players, but that's only on special occasions.
Well, you know, I don't know that I would agree with that, Frank. I mean, I think...
Go ahead, agree.
I think there's no question there was a connection between the fans of Toronto and the Argonauts, particularly in 82 and 83, because they were a good team and they had a lot of great guys and there was lots of interesting characters and so on. But I think from my perspective, I think of what's now the Rogers Center, was originally called Sky Dome. I mean, I remember a year after that building opened in 1990, when the Argos had Don Matthews as the head coach and they had the shoot out the lights offense with Dunnigan and Ricky Foggy. I remember guys, I remember Darrell K. Smith scoring touchdowns and actually jumping into the front rows of down in the lower bowl because you're so close to the fans down there. I mean, now they actually tarp some of those seats off, as you know. But
yep.
I mean, and I also remember going back in sort of the Flutie years, they'd have a thing where you could go down and eat chicken hot dogs down in the end zone before the game, and the players would all come and high five everybody that was there. So I think there's still a pretty and I actually think that there's more community involvement, I think, now between the Argos and the community than there was then. Although some of the players back then say, they'd made tons and tons of appearances and they did a lot of things, and they don't think that happens as much now. I don't know. You'd almost have to sort of, get the data and see how many appearances by the players and how many times has the Grey Cup been around to schools. I know my daughter's a teacher. And she actually, her school is part of the huddle up against bullying
yep.
thing.
Yep.
And they had, so last year, I guess it would have been maybe around a year ago this time, Mike Bradwell came to the school and gave a presentation along with Jason Calero, who's one of the Argos front office people, gave a presentation about bullying, and they said, when we win the Grey Cup, we're bringing it back to this school. And they did. They brought that
yep.
Grey Cup back to that school. Andrew Jones came in. My daughter got her class all wearing Argo helmets and all kinds of stuff. And they do a lot of that stuff. I don't disagree with you about the fact that, we don't have access to where they park their cars, and we don't see them come and go out of the building and that sort of thing. You're absolutely right about that. The Sky Dome is a massive structure, and any player for the Argos or the Blue Jays can come and go out of that place without anybody ever detecting them. Whereas at Exhibition Stadium, the players' parking lot was right behind the south stands.
Absolutely, and they used to walk out to their cars,
yeah,
and they would sign autographs on the way out to their cars.
Yeah, it's kind of like it was at Ivor Wynne Stadium as well. And it's, in fact, still, well, was until they tore down Ivor Wynne Stadium. But, yeah, so that's been lost, no question.
Well,
but,
you were saying about the data, okay, Paul? I guess the only data I need to know personally is when you were talking about the players jumping into the stands and high-fiving all the fans and making that personal contact with the fans, how many fans in the stands were there at that time? Were there 21,000?
No, great question. I mean, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? This is what I'm getting at, is that the only data that I need is when the team was accessible and the fans were able, and I mean this in the most polite and general way, were able to touch the players, literally, there were more fans in the stands. The more protected the players become, the less interested I think the fans become, because they become, quite honestly, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, is that the further away you keep the players from the fans, the less connected the fans are to the players. To me, that's a slam dunk. That's an easy, it's an easy thing to decide. There has to be, I think, with you, when you get Hamilton, you said it yourself, until this very year when the stadium was, Ivor Wynne was taken down, the players had no choice but to meet the fans. They couldn't hide from them. And that's not a bad thing, because 99% of the fans that love their team, win or lose, they love their players. They might hate them a little bit during the game when it's going bad at that very moment, but, as soon as the game's over, they're fans again, and they're not angry. It doesn't take long for fans of football to lose their anger about their team. I mean, otherwise, Toronto wouldn't have had so many fans for so many years. You put a different spin on it. I know that maybe they liked losing. That sounds really that's a very disarming thought that the fans enjoyed losing. I when you said that, I I half-heartedly have to say I agree. It sure seemed like it because they didn't complain about losing. They almost enjoyed it, it seemed.
Yeah, so I think that was true.
The connection is important between the, don't you think, the connection between the players and the fans. They're becoming so, the only time you can make contact with them now is if they're signing an autograph and you're handing over a couple of bucks. That seems to be, or there's a book somebody's signing, and a player writes a book, and then you get to meet them that way. Do you think the days are over of those days back, that you're talking about, the 80s, the early 80s, where the players seem to be more connected to the fans and the fans seem more connected to the players? Do you think we'll ever get back to that in football?
Well, I don't agree. I actually think there's more connection now. I mean, you talked about there's a certain number of games every year where you can go down on the field and actually interact with players. And the fact is there's three or four games a year where you can go and interact with players after the game. A lot of guys go to one of the restaurants on Front Street after the game. If you go to the Grey Cup, you will encounter tons of active and retired Canadian football players, and you'll have a beer with them. I think of all of the pro sports, the Canadian Football League is the most connected directly to the fans, and the Argonauts, I think, are I would argue probably more connected now than they probably were back then. I don't know that there was the same. I mean, other than sort of the coming and going to your car after the game, I don't really know that there was a whole lot of direct interaction between Argo fans and Terry Greer or Condridge Holloway to the same extent that there is now, when they can get a chance to go and be on the field and chat with Ricky Ray or with Chad Owens or whoever. I think that's not really why the attendance has gone down. I think there's a lot of reasons for it, but I don't think lack of direct connection is one of them, and I guess we'll have a difference of opinion on that point. But
no, the only reason I say it is because there was more time. It seems, I don't know. It just seems to me that when I went to the game, and I have to admit, I was young. If I wanted to talk to a player, like I said, I could go to the fence and call him over, and he'd come over and talk and say hello and that kind of stuff. The accessibility that I'm referring to is unstaged connection, an unstaged connection. But then again, I can't argue with you because I've been to Shoeless Joe's after every game, and the players are very accessible. I'm not referring to the players now are trying to avoid the fans by any
right.
stretch. No. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I am saying that because of the way the sporting community, the way society has grown and changed, people travel with more fear now, more protection with whatever they do. I mean, it's getting down to the point where, as horrible as it sounds, in the United States, they're putting in armed security guards in grade schools. Do you know what I mean? And so by virtue of that, you have protection of players, which they deserve, right? But at the same time that you're protecting them, you're distancing them from the fans as well. You know what I mean? Like, don't go on the field. Don't touch the guy. When the guy comes in, you'll get kicked out. Those types of rules that didn't exist before. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I'm talking about the incidental contact between fans and players because the players were accessible. But now they can't be. I'm not blaming this on anyone. If that's what it sounded like, no. I'm not blaming it on anyone. I'm just saying it's a change in the way life works nowadays. So, I don't
disagree with that, but I think my argument would be that of all of the professional sports, the CFL is the one that is least afflicted by that.
Absolutely. They're the league. The league is the league of the common man. Football is the common man's sport. There aren't 2,000. Well, there might be the odd $2,000 suit in the stands in Toronto, but per capita, not as many as you would see at a hockey game. So I totally into what you're saying. We agree. Trust me, we agree. But I'm just talking about the way society has changed. And football is a real common man game. It's it has everything that the average guy or gal wants to do. There's physicalness, there's speed, strength, intelligence. And because of the way the game is played, you have all those in different, you know, in different, they're encapsulated. Whereas, you know, to pick out a smart hockey player, he could be a goalie, he could be a defenseman, he could be a forward, you know, just like in football. But in football, we have brute strength as a main ingredient for the line. We have a quarterback that has to be really intelligent and know what he's doing. Receivers that are reactive, you know, as are, you know, defensive backs. We have, it's like, you know, it's, you know, it's it takes on all the different qualities of people. There is not a type, like in basketball, automatically when you're short, you know, 90% of the time you're not going to be able to play basketball because it is against your ability. Ability means so much, or physique means so much. Whereas in football, every type of person, every body type is involved in that game. You know, and that's what I admire about football, is that it is the common man game. And you know, and they are common men. They are, for the most part, especially Canadian Football League players, they're very kind and gentle and welcoming people. I haven't ran into too many that aren't. I've met some shy ones that wish they didn't have to talk, you know, publicly. You know what I mean? But that's about the worst thing I can say about them. That's absolutely the worst thing I can say about them. So, yeah.
Great bunch of guys for sure in the CFL. So, and that was the case back then, and it's the case now. And we're so lucky that that is the case, right?
Oh, for sure. Well, when you look at the guys back there in the 80s, there, you know, Kelvin Prunster, outside tackle, was a rookie. And here he is winning a Grey Cup. You know, it must have been one of the greatest feelings in the world. We you know, we see players from time to time that go 20 years without making it, never mind to winning the Grey Cup, but actually showing up for a Grey Cup. What it must be like historically, looking back, you know, 30 years later for a guy like Kelvin Prunster. You know, you were talking about Newman, right?
Yeah.
He had a little more experience. He was a little longer in the tooth. But at that time, I guess there was even Paul Pearson was on that team. And this is a Canadian who was just, you know, just beginning his career. So
yeah, well, you talk about Kelvin. I mean, you know, he did. He won. There was only two rookies on that team in 83. And the guys on the offensive line, they ragged him a fair bit about the fact you weren't here in 81. You didn't go through Willie Wood's practices. You didn't suffer like us. You just come in and just in time to win it all. And he took a fair bit of a ribbing on that. And, you know, he said, you know, I thought this is the way it's always going to be, right? You know, you come in as a rookie and you win the Grey Cup and you have the best record in the team's history. And of course, it didn't turn out to be the winning. Didn't win it every single year. Although Kelvin actually was one of seven guys, and I was amazed to see that the number was that big. Seven players or seven men, one six players and one coach, were on the '83 Argonauts and were still there in 1991 when they won it again. Completely different regime. They've gone through a couple of changes of you know, coaches. But there were seven guys that were there for both, and Kelvin was one of them. And he was fortunate to come out of school and walk into a great lineup. And by midway through the season in '83, he was starting. He lost his starting job towards the end and was very disappointed to find that he wasn't going to be starting in the Eastern Final or the Grey Cup. But then Tom Trefo got hurt in the Grey Cup, and Kelvin ended up playing the second half and was a big part of that win.
Yeah, absolutely. And Trefo, to this day, mentions that doesn't matter how often he sees them, it's like they won the Grey Cup just yesterday.
Yeah, there's so many guys that they have such a bond with each other from that time, Frank. I've had a lot of those guys tell me that's the most fun they had. They loved that group. They loved each other. They do. They pick up as if they never left off when they run into each other 30 years later. There was a special bond with the 1982 and 83 Argonauts. And the guys that were there in 81, the guys that were there for all three of those years, particularly share that bond. You know, they say, we suffered through 81. It made 82 and 83 that much more special. It made us that much more determined to win by having to go through that terrible year in 81.
And not only did they worry or have 81 as a memory and as a lock as far as memory is concerned, Jan Krinsche, I liked another one of his quotes, and that was the fact that he was watching TV when Leon McQuay and the Argos lost that Grey Cup. So, you know, after he slipped and fumbled, you know, he cried for about a week. And that was just a horrible play for him. It broke his heart to have that happen. So to imagine how happy he was to be one of the reasons why the Grey Cup was going to be lifted in Toronto, and Toronto was going to be victorious, and he was going to be part of that parade. So there are a lot of ways, you know, the CFL players, you know, they are the fans as well when they're younger because of the Canadians that are involved. And the biggest motivator for a lot of these young Canadian players, and I'm having good fortune here to meet a few of the young players, two of them a week for that matter, for the past month or so, and there's a common thread, and that is they are proud to play in the CFL. They can't wait to play in the CFL because they want a shot at that Grey Cup. So, you know, don't underestimate how important this is to guys like Paul Pearson and Condridge Holloway, as you said, and Joe Barnes, Tom Trefoil, Calvin Prunster. But it's very important to the Canadian players because there's a history there for them, not to take anything away from the Americans.
No, absolutely. And in fact, you know, that's one of the parallels between the 83 Argonauts and the 2012 Argonauts. The 2012 Argos, who won the Grey Cup last year, I think they had 12 guys on their roster who are from the Toronto area. They're hometown kids. You know, they're from Toronto. They're from Aurora. They're from places around town. And the 83 Argonauts had, I believe, 7 or 8 guys that were Toronto kids on that team. The two co-captains who were presented the Grey Cup were Jan Krinsche and Dan Ferroni. And you know, Jan is from Scarborough and Dan's from Oakville. And you told the story about Jan, you know, crying over Leon, and you know, Dan followed them as well. And Steve Aykroyd, he grew up. He's from Montreal originally, but he grew up in Mississauga, and he was actually I think coached by Roger Scales, who played on the 71 Argonauts. So you know, there's a lot of connections with the hometown and with the Argos among those guys, and we're lucky that we've got it now. And in fact, you mentioned at the opening of the show, the Argos made the trade today with Calgary, picked up a linebacker, another kid from the Toronto area, right? They're loading it up with kids who grew up cheering for the Argos, and I think that's a good thing.
It's a great motivator.
Absolutely, you want guys that feel a bond with that team, one of the things in my book would be I put together, you know, a few lists of, you know, intriguing things, you know, who won awards and who was on the All-Star team those years, and one of the lists I put together was who was from Toronto, and there was a bunch of guys, you know, 81, 82, and 83, all three of those years there was a pretty heavy Toronto connection among the non-imports on those teams.
Absolutely. Now we'll have some fun. Let's see if these names begin to ring a bell. Okay, I finally found the roster of that 83 team.
Oh, good stuff.
All right, Gary Greer, Emmanuel Tolbert. Stop me when you want to talk about somebody. Emmanuel Tolbert. I want to talk about him because he was not a football player his whole life, if I remember correctly. Oh my goodness. I love my long-term memory. I haven't lost that. I've lost a lot of my short-term memory, but my long-term memory, I have some of it left. He was a runner who really wasn't a football player, but man, did he learn fast. Paul Pearson, we talked about. Jeff Townsend, Greg Holmes, Cedric Minter, we mentioned. Jan Krinsche, John Palazzetti, Joe Barnes, Condridge Holloway, Tom Trefoil, Dan Travone, Tony Antunovic, Mike Hamilek. Mike Hamilek,
yeah.
Boy, that name rings a bell. John Malinowski, absolutely. Bill Norton, another one. Kelvin Prunster, Earl Wilson, Stephen Del Cole, Franklin King, Rick Moore, James Curry. He was one of the toughest, I'll say, players that played on the edge. Wouldn't that be a fair definition of James Curry?
Yeah, it definitely would. I had a player said to me, you know, James would cut his grandma off at the knees if she was in his way. He was a mean, and he was a big, aggressive defensive end. The last guy that joined that team, you know, he's not even on the team photo. If you look at the the official picture of the 1983 Toronto Argonauts was taken probably about a month before the season ended. And Curry's not in that picture because he joined them, I think, with three games left in the season or four games left in the season. I know he started the year with the BC Lions, and I think he was traded to Montreal and then cut or something like that happened, and the Argos picked him up, and he was really the final piece of the puzzle. They hadn't really figured out who was going to play the right defensive end position. They went through a few guys. They went through Lyle Wasnesensky. They went through Matthew Teague, and there was a couple of guys that played defensive end on the opposite side from Rick Moore. And when Curry got there, their line became vicious. I mean, with Curry and Moore on the end, and Bob Wilson,
another guy to mention: Tony Lawson, Don Moen. Now, Don Moen, we know him today because he's gone through the coaching ranks. Gordon Elser.
Don Bolt was a great story. Don came over to the Argonauts right at the end of training camp in 82. He was, that was a great move that Toby and Ralph made. They made a trade to get three guys from the BC Lions after training camp ended. Don Bolt was one of them. Rob Smith, who was an offensive lineman, they didn't end up playing much for the Argos, but had a very good career in the CFL. And Rick Moore, and they gave up future considerations or basically nothing to get those tickets. Rick Moore, of course, became an all-star defensive end. Tom Malone initially was a special teams guy, a linebacker who played special teams. But by midway through 83, his second season, he was starting at linebacker, and he started more games at linebacker than anybody in the history of the Toronto Argonauts. He's on the all-time Argo team at linebacker. And when he started his career as a pro, he was too small to be linebacker. He was a safety in college out at Simon Fraser, I believe it was. And I've had his teammates telling me, you know, when he came in from BC, we're looking at each other like, is this guy's a linebacker? He's 200 pounds. And he bulked up, and he worked on speed, and he worked on everything he had to do. He became a great special teams guy initially, and he eventually became a starter. Jan Carinci told me, he said, there's certain guys that there's a line you have to cross, and there's certain guys that do get across that line and certain guys that don't. And he said, Don Moen is the guy that got across that line. He made himself a starter. And he's another guy that was on that team in 91. He was there for 83, and he was still starting in 91, and he was a captain in 91. So great pickup by Ralph and Obi at the end of training camp. They saw something, I guess, in scouting the preseason games that year. I think they brought in Donnie Moen basically to be a special teams guy. Little did they know he was going to become an all-time Argonaut linebacker.
Gordon Elser, William Mitchell, Ken McEachran, Daryl Nicholson, Daryl Wilson. We mentioned Steve Aykroyd, and this is where I'm going to stop. If I remember correctly, Carl Brazely started as an Ottawa Rough Rider, didn't he?
Yes, he did. No, that's not true. He started as the Montreal Alouette.
Was it an Alouette?
He played his first year with the Alouettes, and then he ended up in Ottawa. Carl's an interesting guy because, as you know, the Argonauts got to the Grey Cup in 1982. When they didn't win, but to get to the Grey Cup in 82, they had to beat the Ottawa Rough Riders at Exhibition Stadium in the Eastern Final. And Carl Brazely got stuck with having to cover Terry Greer one-on-one that game. And nobody in the CFL, even someone as good as Carl Brazely, and Carl was a fantastic defensive back, nobody could cover Terry Greer one-on-one. You needed help. And he didn't get any help until the second half, and by then the Argos were up 29-0. And then Carl, he's the second last piece of the puzzle. We talked about James Curry arriving late in 83. A few weeks earlier, Carl Brazely arrived. He's got an interesting story. He'd been in, obviously, with Ottawa in 82, and he told me he had thought he was the lowest paid defensive back in the entire league. He was stupid, didn't know what to sign for, and he thought he was getting taken advantage of. But he went to camp with the Rough Riders in 83. And they, for some reason, they decided to cut him, even though he clearly was capable of playing in the CFL. It might have been, I don't know what they were thinking, but they cut him. And he got cut early enough in camp, he went down to the Buffalo Bills. He was in camp with the Bills, and they wanted to keep him around on kind of an unofficial taxi squad. And they said, you know, just hang around town, we'll get you in the lineup. And he just decided he wasn't going to do that. He got phoned back home in Kentucky, I think, or might have been in Buffalo, but he got called by Bob Vilovich, who coached him in Ottawa in 81 after he left the Alouettes and moved to Ottawa. And Ovi said, "Carl, we want you to come up to Toronto." So he brought him up, and Brazy was actually in a hotel, and he was waiting to go over to the stadium to kind of sign his contract and stuff. And as he was just getting ready, I think Ovi or somebody was coming to pick him up. It might have been Ovi picking him up at the hotel. He's just leaving the hotel room. His phone rings, and he says, "Well, I got to go and get the ride with Ovi." So he goes and gets in the car with Ovi and drives down to the stadium. Signs the contract, comes back to the hotel, listens to his message, and it's the Bills saying, "We want you back." So, for not answering that phone in that hotel room that day, we got the benefit of having Carl Brazy, who was a hugely important player for the Toronto Argonauts in 83 and also in 91. He was the most outstanding defensive player in the Grey Cup in 83. He picked off the pass, and he did a fumble recovery that you almost never see. He strips the ball right out of the guy's hands and started running the other way. You never see that. He just reached into the running back's hands, grabbed that ball, and started going the other way. And he was picked the defensive player of the game in that Grey Cup, and he was a fantastic defensive back for the Argos for many seasons. And if he'd picked up that phone in that hotel room that day, he would have gone back to the Bills probably.
And he probably would have signed a contract with them.
Oh yeah, they wanted to. They said, "Come back, we need you here."
Well, good for the Argo fans. He ended up staying with the Argos, signing with the Argos, and going on to become the best defensive player in the Grey Cup game in '83. Along with the best offensive player was Joe Barnes, another player that really, when the season in mid-season or at the beginning of the season, you wouldn't have thought that he would have won the MVP. Although he had great credentials. And the one thing I remember about Joe Barnes is the joke around town was he could make three passes and not get a first down.
That's funny. I don't remember ever hearing that about Joe.
No?
That was Tony Adams,
But I'll tell you, he turned around and won the Grey Cup, didn't he? That's why I'm saying that. I'm making fun of the negative comments that players get to overcome by having success. Success is in sports, it forgives everything. Everything gets forgiven. Almost everything gets forgiven if you're successful in sports. And we can also mention Rick Klassen of BC was the most valuable Canadian in that Grey Cup game. We're going to take another break. We'll be back, and we'll talk some more about that 81 team. And we went through the first third of the season. We'll finish the two-thirds of the season. We go out on the show, and we'll be back with Paul Woods, author of soon-to-be-released book, Bouncing Back. The story of the 81 to 83 Argonauts.
There's an unwritten code in Hamilton. If you live by it, chances are you've replaced the last beer in a cooler. You don't talk during the national anthem. You believe that great things can come from a little room above a fruit stand. You know Mac is a university, not a computer. Your child's first words were Oski Wee Wee. You know a red hat looks good with black and gold, and understand that double blue only looks good on the police. You believe hot water isn't a necessity for the visitor's dressing room. You've hit every green light on Main Street twice. You believe there's a little general in all of us. You only wear your good hard hat to games. You know King Kong was more than an ape, he was a five-time All-Star. You've parked on somebody's lawn to catch a kickoff. You know that Porter is a quarterback, not a bellhop. You've worn a kilt to a football game. You understand that every once in a while you have to be the center. You believe a football team can outlast 22 prime ministers, 2 world wars, a great depression, and still give birth to a pearl. You've worn a garbage bag as a raincoat. You've never seen a fair catch. You pick a concession line not based on how long the line is, but how hot that cashier looks. You understand that Labor Day is more than an extra day off. And no matter what happens on the field, your season is a success if you beat the Argos.
Okay, Paul, you feel like you need a little bit of a break? I can give you another 3 minutes if you like.
No, we're good.
We're good?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so So, oh, by the way, oh my goodness, terrible. We got off on Carl Brazely so far. I forgot to mention another player that had a good career with the Argos, Marcellus Green, Leroy Paul, and a guy named Hank Alissek.
Oh, yes. That's lots of good stories about Hank. And, in fact, I'll be talking to Hank tomorrow. I'm doing one of the last interviews for the book with Hank tomorrow night. But, you know, and let me just go back to Marcellus Green for a second, just for a little trivia for you Argo fans. He was traded to Saskatchewan for Joe Barnes, and then he came back. He was with the Argos in 81, was traded, he was recruited by Willie Wood, traded to Saskatchewan, Joe Barnes came back to Toronto, and then by 83, Marcellus was back and was one of the defensive backs in that 83 lineup. But Hank Alissek is you know, a guy that the guys speak very highly of. They kind of roll their eyes a little bit. He missed three field goals in that Grey Cup. Nobody really was too happy about that, but he made one in the fourth quarter. And, of course, his punts that day were, and his punts all season were incredibly important in field position. They had they just kept pounding the Lions back deep in their end zone every possession in that second half as the Argos slowly fought back from a 10-point deficit and eventually, of course, took the lead on Minter's touchdown with 3 minutes to go.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about defense and players being successful on defense. A good offense can help a defense get a lot better. A bad offense just makes a good defense not so good. It's just natural. It's the way it is. And field position by a punter? Goodness gracious, if you don't have the goalpost shadows, your offense can play a lot easier when you've got room behind you. Nothing worse than being pinned in the either anywhere between the 5 and the 15-yard line. It is hard to play from there.
Yeah, Hank should be in the Canadian Football Hall of Fame. To me, it's a travesty that he hasn't been elected yet, and he will eventually get in there. I mean, the guy, he's got to be considered, if not the greatest punter in the history of Canadian football, certainly one of them. And at least I'm talking about the modern era. I mean, of course, there were some amazing kickers back in the 20s and 30s and 40s, but when the game was a lot different than it is now. But Hank had a unique kicking motion. The ball just exploded off his leg. He barely seemed to get the leg above the knee, and yet the ball would go a mile. Guys said to me, you know, you'd be waiting. It seemed like you're waiting for an hour for that ball to come down.
And you know, what do you think it is that works against Hank? Is it possibly because he was a strange bird in getting inducted into the Hall of Fame?
Well, yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, that might be part of it. I mean, I think, you know, you never know. The Canadian Football Hall of Fame, the selection process is very secretive. You don't hear. It's not like baseball where the writers vote and everybody's vote is reported and publicized. It's they just announce one day who's been chosen, and it's a small group, I think, that makes the decision, and we don't really know what goes into those decisions. I think politics plays into it. I certainly think that the reason it took so long for Dan Ferroni to get in was politics. I mean, he was active in the Players Association for many years, and I think that worked against him because, you know, I don't want to mean any disrespect for some of the other guys who've gone in the Hall of Fame in recent years, and particularly the two offensive linemen who come to mind, Rocco Romano and Pierre Vercheval, great players, but I think Dan Ferroni was unquestionably a better player than those guys, and he didn't get in as fast as they did. Hank, I don't know. I mean, Hank might be because you know, he was a bit of a strange bird, like a lot of kickers are. I don't know. It's a great question. It makes no sense to me because he was an incredible punter for many, many, many years. The only guy in the modern history of Canadian football to play in the Grey Cup as a high school student. You know, he was 17 years old
in Edmonton.
In
yep,
NFL. Yep, yeah. And he was in the Grey Cup for his first seven seasons. He won the Grey Cup six times in his first seven seasons.
Five in a row.
Yep, five in a row. Actually, six in a row because he won it with the Argos after winning it five times.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. He lost the first year in '77, and he went on to win every, you know, the next 6 years with two teams. And he was also on that 91 team, another one of those guys that was there for both 83 and 91.
You know, it is an interesting history that the Argos have, and that is a real strange blip. 81 to 83, really, 81 epitomized the failure that was the Argos. The loved failure, you know. I mean, they were loved by their fans. Whether it was a negative love or a positive love doesn't matter to me. The love that matters to me, as far as I'm concerned, is the marching through the turnstiles, and the fans continued to march through the turnstiles all those years, no matter how badly the team played. But it seems when they hit rock bottom, it almost was, a good thing that those players really had a horrible year. I think that built them towards winning the Grey Cup. Nothing enhances your desire to win than losing badly more.
Yeah, there's no question. The funny thing is, I mean, you know, I heard Condra Holloway say he knew he had talent on that team. He said, we couldn't wait to get to camp in 82. Despite winning two games in 81, despite all the terrible things that happened as that year went on, some of those guys couldn't wait to get to camp in 82. They had bonded with each other. There's been incredible closeness built up among a certain core group of players who were there again in 82, and they felt we're not far from being a good team, and they were dying to get at it again in 82, and sure enough, they came out in 82 and started winning and playing exciting football and turned things around real quick.
Well, you know, I think the biggest and most important thing they developed was a development of trust between each other. They all grew as a team through the ashes of those losses to become what they became in 83. And that's a testament to many teams through the ages. The Edmonton Oilers lost to the New York Islanders when the New York Islanders won that last Grey Cup, and they rolled past Gretzky and Messier and company. It made that team, and they say, and many have heard them talk about the fact that it was losing against the Islanders four straight and the way they lost that really got them motivated and taught them a very important lesson on what it means to play in a championship. And there were a lot of Argo players who tasted adversity, didn't like it, and wanted to go to the other side, and they knew they had the guys beside them that could take them there. And that's got
to
be a good feeling.
More importantly, Frank, you know, to use that, what you're talking about, what really happened was between 82 and 83, the Argos lost the Grey Cup in 82 against a veteran Edmonton team that was like that Islanders team. They knew how to win. And they came back in 83 with the same attitude that the Eskimos had brought in 82, that they weren't going to be defeated. It was businesslike. It was serious. We're going to win this game. And the BC Lions, who were the host team in 83, were like the Argos in 82. They were excited to be there. They were a bit giddy and overly enthusiastic and playing on the hometown atmosphere and so on. And they ran up against an Argonaut team that had been through the loss the year before to an experienced side, had learned from it, and wasn't going to be denied.
And they weren't denied, that's for sure. Let's talk a little bit about the final part of the 81 season that was the making of the 83 championship team. We talked about them going into Hamilton. I think we then left it off in Ottawa where Tom Clemens ripped the team apart. How did the rest of the season go for that team?
Well, it wasn't Clemens in 81. It was actually Condridge Holloway.
Oh, Condridge Holloway.
Sorry, it wasn't. God, who was it for the Ottawa in 81? It was, I don't think it was J.C. Watts at that time. I think it was Jordan Case. It doesn't really matter. Bottom line is, if you want to hear what, you know, some of the things that happened at the end of the 81 season were strange. The one that really sticks out in my mind is... of course, every year, now that they don't call them the Shenley Awards anymore, the Shenley Distillery no longer sponsors the awards, but the Shenley Awards were the player awards back then, and the process has always been that there are nominations from each team initially, usually with about 3 weeks left in the season. The team nominees are announced, and then it gets down to the division finalists, and then finally the winners are announced during the Grey Cup week. And in 81, the Argo nominees were announced, about 3 weeks left in the season. The most outstanding player nominee for the Argonauts was Paul Pearson, a Canadian receiver, also nominated as most outstanding Canadian. And he'd had a very good year that year in what was overall a very poor season by the Argonauts, of course. But he'd really had a breakout year as a receiver. the odd thing was he had been benched the week that he was nominated as the most outstanding player because Tommy Hudspeth, who was the head coach after Willie Wood left, put Paul Pearson in a position that he shouldn't have been playing, put him in at fullback, and he didn't like the way he blocked for Cedric Minter out in a game out in Winnipeg, and so he benched him. And so here you've got the most outstanding player on the team sitting on the bench, and the most outstanding defensive player of the Argonauts in 1981 was a linebacker named Danny Bass, who had been traded 2 weeks earlier to the Calgary Stampeders. So your best player has been on the bench, and your best defensive player is not even in town anymore. That just shows you what a weird year it was. The other thing that sticks out of my mind right at the end of the season, they had a couple of very improbable wins and could have made the playoffs. I mean, they'd won one more game. If they'd beaten Hamilton in the last game of the season, they'd still make the playoffs despite only having – they would have won three games. They ended up only winning two, of course, and so they didn't make it. But Montreal got in with three. And I think it might have been the second last game of the season. They went out to Edmonton. And they had – we thought the Hamilton loss was bad. They lost to Hamilton earlier in the season 57-13 in week four, which at the time was the most points the Argonauts had ever surrendered. Well, they topped that. They lost to Edmonton 61-7. And the only points that they scored that night – and this is such a bizarre little trivia. The only touchdown the Argonauts scored in that game in Edmonton – the only touchdown in the history of Jim Corrigal. He scored a touchdown. He got a fumble recovery and managed to – I think he actually booted the ball down into the end zone and then ran down and fell on it for a touchdown. And so they didn't get blank 61-0. Doug Smith, I think it was, offensive lineman with the Argos, told me that that was – that year, 81, was the 75th anniversary of the city of Edmonton, and they were running up that score. He thought they're going for 75 on us. They're going to try to score 75 points on us for their 75th birthday, and they held them to 61. You know, so there you go. You had the two worst scores in the history of the Argonauts in the same season.
And Jim Corrigal wasn't a bad defensive player.
No kidding. Greatest defensive end maybe in the history of the Argonauts. And he only scored one touchdown, and it happened to be in his final season, I think maybe his second last game he ever played, and it happened to be the only points that they scored in a game where they were beaten by 54 points.
Now, Jim Corrigal, let's talk about him, because that is a player who, in his career, was one of the best Argos of his era.
No question.
You know, and there was nobody more dedicated to winning. What happened with him? Was he still hanging around the team? I guess he retired in 81?
Jim Corrigal was actually in 81. He was, at the start of the season, he was named a player coach. Willie Wood asked him to serve as a defensive line coach and a player. I don't think he initially played much that season. He was fighting off some type of injury, and so he wasn't on the active roster at the start of the season. But eventually, he got into the lineup. And the one thing I've heard from a few of the offensive linemen who played on other teams, Roland Mangold and Mike Hamiluk and Doug Smith, all told me we used to hate playing the Argos because their defensive line was just nasty. It was Corrigal, Bruce Smith, Wayne Smith, Ecomet Burley, Granny Liggins. And, of course, in 80 and 81, they had Bruce Clark, who was probably the most talented defensive lineman that's ever played in Canadian football. He only lasted 2 years because he went back to the NFL and played a decade down there. He was the fourth overall pick in the NFL draft and somehow managed to sign with the Argos instead of with the Green Bay Packers. But you know, Corrigal was an incredible defensive end. Willie Wood asked him to be a defensive line coach and a playing coach, and he did play in 81. Once Willie was fired, Corrigal stopped coaching. He just stepped down as playing coach and went back to being a straight player. I don't think he wasn't happy about Willie's termination, I guess. And the Argos, you know, they futzed around with them. Both he and Bruce Clark got put out of position. They put Corrigal inside at tackle and Bruce Clark outside at defensive end, and both guys were not designed to play those spots. Corrigal was an end and Clark was a tackle. And at the end of the season, Corrigal was furious. I mean, there was a great story, and I think Rick Matsumoto wrote it in the Toronto Star, describing Corrigal screaming with anger after the Argos lost another game. I think it was the Hamilton game, the last game of the season that put them out of the playoffs. I hate losing. I'm sick of this. Just yelling and screaming it in the locker room. You said he was a guy who loved winning. There's no question he did. But more than that, Jim Corrigal hated losing.
And well, absolutely.
He really hated that 81 season and what was going on with the Argos. And we'll never, I guess we'll probably never know the full story about what happened afterwards. I mean, you know, Bob Obilovich said to me, you know, one of the difficult things I had to do was I had to tell Jim Corrigal that we didn't want him to come back. And I think that was a case where they felt, you know, it was age and his best days were behind him, and they were trying to change the culture of the team. And so they decided to cut the cord to Corrigal, let him go, and he ended up going back down to the States, and he's coached some colleges and things like that. But, you know, he's never really kind of reappeared in Toronto the way I wish he would. He's obviously in the Canadian Football Hall of Fame, and he certainly, I think it's fair to say, the greatest defensive end I ever saw play for the Argonauts. Love to see him back in and around the team at some point, but I don't think it's ever going to happen somehow.
Well, I wouldn't say that, and here's why I wouldn't say that, Mr. Woods. Dave Keon didn't look like he'd ever come back here, and as a big fan of Dave Keon's, as I was of Jim Corrigal, both players, to me, I held in high esteem, equally to how much disdain I felt towards the teams, and at my young age, because I don't understand the politics of football and the politics of hockey, and how Keon was treated by Ballard and Corrigal was treated by the Argonauts. You know, so, I mean, Keon's made his way back, and I believe Corrigal will come back. Eventually, he's going to have to set aside the ownership that was there, and the management team that was in power is no longer a factor. And maybe it's more important, like we say about who do you play for when it comes to any sport? You play for the name on the front, not the name in the back. So, you know, if he comes back, he'll come back because of the name in the front. You know?
Yeah, I don't want to make it sound like, I don't know that this is a similar situation to Dave Keon. I don't think that Jim Corrigal is totally estranged from the Argonauts organization. I was more thinking sort of, you know, in my sort of romanticized desire that I would love it if he ever came back and was a coach with the team or something like that. And I don't really see that happening, but I think he's been back. I think he came back when they announced the all-time Argonauts team. I can't really be sure about that, but I'm pretty sure he was back for that. And you know, I think it's not like we'll never see Jim Corrigal set foot in Rogers Center. I would like it if he was actually kind of, you know, an active part of the organization, just because he was one of my favorite players growing up, and I'd love to see him back. But
mine too.
I think enough time's passed at this point that that's probably not going to happen. But you never know. Maybe he will. Who knows?
Mine too. Two of my favorite Argos of all time: Dick Shadow and Jim Corrigal.
Yeah.
But Shadow,
of course, was the GM for a while, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, Dick Shadow was a class act and a great player. And there were many class acts. You know, he's just one that I'm gravitating towards. You know, one of my favorite coaches of all time is Bob Obilovich. I always enjoyed his post-game interviews. No, you know, we played really well. We should have been a little tougher in the trenches.
His voice. Players love to imitate Obi.
His voice wasn't a football voice, that's for sure. But he was such a great guy. And, you know, he was an intense man, but always under control. But you could see he was upset. You know, get that sweat on his forehead, and you know he was angry. And I'm sure the players understood it, too. And he wasn't a very big man, but he had a giant heart. And he was a smart football guy. We were lucky to have him.
He knew Canadian football, there's no doubt. I mean, basically the story with Obi was, you know, he Ralph Fazio brought him in to interview him. And I mean, we'll never know the full story because Ralph's gone now, but he pretty much acknowledged that he really wasn't, that Obilovich was not high on his list. And when Obi came in for the interview, they looked up 4 hours later, they were still talking. The two of them hit it off. They both had such an agreement on how to do things in Canadian football, and Obi was brought in, and he was the guy. He turned that team around in 1 year. They went from 2-14 to the Grey Cup. That's a lot of that's because of Bob Vilovich.
Absolutely, he was a throwback coach. You know, he was nothing like Mouse Davis. Like, he wasn't that kind of coach. You know, really, really tricky. You know what I mean? Well, Vilovich was a hard-working kind of guy.
Well, you know, Bob will tell you that run and shoot offense wasn't all Mouse. That Bob had input into that too, and I'm sure that's true. I mean, Bob knew Canadian football inside out, and he knew things that run and shoot offense would work in this particular environment. These are the rules that apply in Canada, and I mean, they were different styles of coaches. Mouse was a gregarious guy, a very positive influence on the field. Always had high praise for his players. Always pushing the guys to get better. I don't think Obilovich was a great speech maker at all.
But, that's what I'm talking about.
different styles, but you know, they both played a role. And hey, Obi's the guy that hired Mouse, so you know
when a guy hires a guy that can fill his blanks, that's a brave guy and a very smart guy. You know, it's very easy to hire somebody who agrees with you.
Yep.
You know, who believes everything you believe. It's a little more difficult when you go outside your comfort zone because you say to yourself, maybe I need to. Bob was is a throwback coach. In the old days, they were all hands-on, and he was a hands-on guy. But he took that time to bring in an innovative kind of coach that he knew wasn't his strength but would make the team better. And that's what I meant when I was saying that he was, Obilovich knew his weaknesses. And Obilovich was an honest guy. I can't remember another general manager or a coach that when he said what he said, whether it was in public or in private, you knew it didn't change. He was one of the most honest, straightforward guys that I ever thought I saw. I didn't know him personally, but, you know, from outside the fishbowl, he seemed like a pretty straightforward guy.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. Although, you know, the players, there's some difference of opinion about Bob. Some guys liked him more than others. Some guys felt that he wasn't a great communicator. Some guys felt that he didn't really attempt to get to know the players the way they would have liked. Taskmaster is the word that I keep hearing to refer to Bob. And of course, he was a fiend for conditioning. He was adamant that we're not going to lose a game because we're out of shape in the fourth quarter. We're going to be in better shape in the fourth quarter than the other guys. And so he ran the guys a lot. They ran lots and lots in practice. And part of that was because they're running an offense that needed you to be able to run. But most of it was we're going to be in better shape than the guys we play.
And he succeeded.
Sure he did. Absolutely.
And he was right because you just defined how they won the Grey Cup in '83. They were behind in the beginning, and they made a comeback.
Yeah, and that game ended in the Eastern Final. They came back to win both games in the dying stages. They won. They took the lead in the Eastern Final with 27 seconds left. They took the lead in the Grey Cup with 3 minutes left. I mean, you don't win a championship without some adversity, and they faced adversity in both those games. And the fact that they were in great condition certainly didn't hurt them in both those games. Now there was a lot of other things too. They didn't. They had a belief that they weren't going to lose, and that somehow we're going to come. We're going to find a way, and that was forged through two seasons of playing under Obilovich and two seasons of growing as a team and all of those things. But there's no question that being in good shape was a good thing for them. I don't know that I would say that the physical conditioning was why they won the Eastern Final or the Grey Cup. But it sure didn't hurt.
Well, it's always good to have the strength to continue and execute, right? Nothing helps execution more than physical well-being, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what, Paul? I don't know how we did it, but we ended up more than a half hour past the hour that was going to be hard to fill.
There you go. It wasn't going to be hard to fill. We got lots of stories. You could talk for years on those Argonaut teams, but we've exhausted a few topics tonight, that's for sure.
Well, one thing I can say for sure is within a month, we'll be back together again to discuss those Argos and touch base again with our friend Paul Woods, on his book, Bouncing Back. And we hope you've enjoyed our little flashback to the 81 season. The 81 season was the season of infamy, as described by Dan Ferrone. And, Paul, I thank you so much. And I look forward to seeing you again in about 2, 3, or 4 weeks, whenever's the next convenient time.
We'll definitely do it again, Frank. Thanks very much for having me.
Paul Woods, thank you very much. And give your wife a kiss goodnight for me. I hope we didn't disturb her.
Yeah. Hopefully she's asleep, that's for sure. I'm ready to fall asleep myself. So
I know, and that's why I'm letting you go, buddy. You've done yeoman's service. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Frank. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Paul Woods. Bouncing Back's the name of the book. It's the 81 to 83 Argonauts. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back for some closing words.
I'm just a regular Joe with a regular job. I'm your average white, least I'd like snob. I like porno and Proline and books about porn. I got an average house with nice hardwood floors. My wife, my job, my kids and my car. My feet on my table and a Cuban cigar. But sometimes that just ain't enough to keep a man like me interested. No way. Now I gotta wear double blue and hit the subway downtown. Yeah, 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 yeah. I need football big on a really big field. No silicone cheerleaders. I want my chicks real. I'm an Argo. I fly to BC and hide all their weed. I go to Regina and say, how about that wheat? I'm an Argo. I'm an Argo. I park in Commonwealth and take Edmonton spaces while Edmonton people make Edmonton faces. I'm an Argo. I'm an Argo.
Maybe I shouldn't be singing this song, raising and carrying on. Maybe they're right when they say that I'm wrong.
Nah. I'm an Argo.
He's an Argo.
I'm an Argo.
He's such a big
Argo. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get myself one of those Condridge Holloway mess jerseys circa 1982 with the midriff showing, just like those skanky Queen Street Lady Gaga wannabe, and walk right into Harbor 60, and there's nothing nobody can do about it. Yeah. And I'm going to talk about the Argos on the radio anytime I want, because unlike that 60-year-old from The Fan who wears sunglasses on TV, I actually go to the games. Okay. They can take their 20 years of boring people with their Dungeons & Dragons staff and have a great big 20-year-old cakewalk right in the middle of Yonge Street, and it will make it look a difference. You know why? Because we got the bombs. Yeah. We got Schultz, Dennegan, frickin' Naylor, and frickin' Randorf. I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna get Bill Simons, Joel Kroll, Terry Greer, and frickin' Don Moen, and a giant case of Crown Royal, and we're gonna go right down.
Hey, you know what, pal? You really are an Argo.
Just shut up and sing the song, pal.
I'm an Argo.
He's an Argo.
He's an Argo.
Hey, Argo. Oh, 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 oh.
I'm an Argo, and I'm proud of it.
And are there any other... He's a radio man, he's a radio man, he's Mike Richards of TSN Radio.
Oh, 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 oh.
Greatest... Morning man and television and radio, Mike Richards. Well, what can we talk about today? Well, you know what? Monday's going to start changing a little bit because we're getting down to the home stretch in the old hockey game. I wanted to mention while I was away on vacation, Stompin' Tom Connors died. And maybe I should download that song, the hockey song. I don't think anybody defines musically Canada better than Stompin' Tom Connors. Neck and Neck, the band, Geddy Lee Rush, maybe. That's about it. And for those of you that want to talk about Gino Vannelli, take a step back. There aren't the Guess Who. But nobody rejected fame and had more fame than they wanted, more than Stompin' Tom Connors. And like hockey, he was Canada. And, Stompin' Tom, we'll miss you, buddy. He used to come down here to the Conroy Hotel where I used to live, and he used to do a bunch of concert every so often. And all I remember is how tall he was, and boy, he could put him back. He was a Canadian, a great Canadian icon. We miss you, Tom. And good news is we have your music left behind. And his music is iconic, to say the least. On his favorite subject, hockey, tonight, the Leafs squeaked one out. They sure did. They edged the Rangers. Man, oh, man, oh, man. They've been, Leafs are getting kind of some rough calls on refereeing. Ranger gets slapped in the knee, goes down like a ton of bricks, no dive called. The Leaf has the puck in the offensive zone, gets tripped while he has the puck. And I attribute that same non-call for the loss against the Flyers. But they overcame the storm. And, of course, let's face it, aside from the fact that they're the richest team in hockey, they're also the most hated team in hockey. While I was in Florida, the Leafs were hitting a bit of a tailspin, and the announcers there on the show were going,
well, you know what's going to happen now. The Leafs are in panic mode because they've lost a few games. They'll panic and they'll do some crazy stuff. Let's go to a commercial now. Tampa, you can get a hockey ticket. Cost you $10. You get two beers, two hot dogs, free parking, and you sit about 8 feet from the boards.
And we're in panic mode? The Leafs are in panic mode? These people are in panic mode all the time, trying to get enough people to show up at the rink. And, they have to give stuff away like crazy. I said earlier on the Argo side of the program that, it costs as much for one Leaf ticket as it does for a season ticket to the Argos. That's not an insult to the Argos. No, God, no, it's not. It is just an amazing desire to watch the Maple Leafs in the ACC. There is not a hotter ticket, almost, I would say, in sports. Once you take away the impact of the NFL, how important the NFL is. I know the tickets are more expensive there, but that's a sport that's in a whole different, we all know that's in a different world. But anyway, the Maple Leafs edged the Rangers, strengthening their playoff hopes. That's what they say here in the CBC. Now, the game that I saw, they really, really, really played a tough game. I mean, anybody who watched the Leafs last year, any amount of adversity, I mean, even if one of them caught a cold, it would be like the team would die, would fall apart. And my player of the year for the Maple Leafs right now, I know you're going to say Reimer. If you said Reimer, I wouldn't argue with you. If you said Lupul, shoot, I wouldn't argue with you either. Once you prorate the games that he played, of course, because he hasn't played much this year. Poor guy keeps getting injured. But my guy is Phil Kessel, a player the Leafs overpaid to get, but they got something. And what they got is a kid who's dedicated to doing what he's asked to do and working within the confines of a system that a coach puts in. And let me tell you, there isn't a player on that Leaf roster who's being asked to play outside of his natural tendencies than Phil Kessel. Phil Kessel is playing like a guy who cares. And, I hear the announcers, say, oh, look, he's squeezing his stick. He's not scoring. He's really upset that he isn't scoring. I'll tell you, though, a couple of minutes after they say that, he sets up a very important goal every time. So, Phil, you got a friend here at Candid Frank Live. I know you're doing your best. I know that you're making a lot of money, and I know the results by many would suggest, on the stat sheet, that you're not earning your keep. But I'm going to disagree with the majority, and I'm going to be the sheep going the other way saying, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me. But I think he's doing a great job. You can't always define a player or an athlete by his salary. I think it's more important you define him by his actions and his attitude. And this kid has a good attitude. And I know for a fact that as much as Carlisle wishes this kid had other natural tendencies, he sure is glad that this kid isn't an albatross around his neck that he has to play and becomes a gun that can't shoot and that shoots himself. This kid has played defense. He's been committed to defense. And I can't say anything nicer about this kid. Phil Kessel, you got my little star for this week. Now, surprises this year. Holy moly, surprises this year. When one looks at the standings, okay, now, maybe I should talk about Ottawa first, because while I'm talking, they're moving so fast from surprisingly good to predictably bad. They are sliding so fast down that scale. I better talk about them first, because they could hit rock bottom by the time I finish talking. The Ottawa Rough Riders were on a heck of a roll. They've lost four in a row, and after winning games that really people didn't think they could win with the players they didn't have. Now, their big gun is back on the ice again, skating, doing his little pirouettes, his little stop-and-go moves. Carlson is back, ready to play, and that's got to be good news for Ottawa. But isn't it ironic that when a key player starts to come back, the team lets down a little bit? How many times have we seen that in sport and in hockey in particular? Sometimes teams play better without their best players because they're more motivated. So the real challenge for Ottawa is, having lost four in a row, they're going to have to make some sort of comeback. And this Canadian team, I hope, does make a comeback. I hope this year will be different than last year, thanks to Ottawa, the only team that was playing in the second round last year of the NHL playoffs. Hopefully, they will be in the playoffs again. And with a little help from the Leafs, because the teams that are behind Ottawa are playing the Leafs this week. They got another game with the Rangers. They've already played. I think they're going to play the Islanders again. So, you know, they've got some games to win. If they don't win, it could be really tough. Because when one looks from 10th to the Leafs, who are at 46, I guess they're at 48 now. It hasn't been posted on the stats here. But anyway, before the night started, there were 6 points separating five teams, of which three make the playoffs. So with 10 or 11 games left in the schedule, those points are a lot, especially when the games get tighter, because what usually happens, and this is the hard part of the end of the season, you get those 2- and 1-point games, those tie games that end up with let's say a team wants to catch somebody. They got to beat them outright, but if they don't beat them outright and you tie them, you only gain a point on them. You know, so it's going to be a tough final few weeks of the season. The end of April, the playoffs are back, and it's going to be interesting to see this town's reaction to a team in the playoffs, how excited they'll get. I know that going back, 93, when Gilmore and the boys made that run and got stopped by the Gretzky train. The other Canadian team in that division, the Montreal Canadiens, they are another surprise. Now, in the context of last year, there's no doubt that Montreal is a surprise in the context of last year. But after they lost to the Boston Bruins on their way to the Bruins' first Stanley Cup, the Montreal Canadiens were a smidge not as good as Boston that went on to win the Stanley Cup. Now, they declined after that. They made some moves that didn't work. They got rid of some players like Cole in the dressing room that were a problem. And you know what? They've made it back up. And they're full value for where they are. You know, many of us, a lot of you, including me, I know I am. You guys can all think of it your way, but I believe that Montreal has made a stupendous turnaround, and they've just proven the theory that I keep promoting over and over and over again, and I will keep promoting it. Management is the key to success. Ownership is the key to good management. If ownership doesn't hire good management, your team ain't going nowhere. When Burke couldn't do anything in the first 2-3 years that he was involved, did not make any serious improvement with the team, he wasn't going to make any serious improvement with the team. The chemistry wasn't there. Now, some will suggest that Nonis is the same as Burke. I disagree. The same way in Montreal, you have a different management in charge, but this was a full house cleaning. This was a complete house cleaning. And look how quickly the team has reacted. And what it took were a couple of smart moves, a couple of intelligent pickups that didn't require giving away your first draft pick for 2 years and a second round draft pick. And I refer, of course, to Phil Kessel earlier, whom I said is a good player. Why he's in Toronto is not his problem. Why players are in a city is not their problem. That's all management. So Montreal has made a change in management, and here they are. Now, this is a team that's a speed team. Will they be able to, as they did back a few years ago when they met Boston in the semifinals, will they lose because they weren't physical enough? Only time will tell. But they have picked up some players to heighten the physicality. And you know what, Montreal fans? You've got a great team to cheer for. Now, in the East Division, there's one more Canadian team, which isn't Canadian. But I think it's the most popular, at least in my community here, the Toronto and Ontario area. I don't think there's a team that has more fans in the Ontario area than the Boston Bruins. And it's starting to look like there isn't a team with more Toronto, Ontario players on their team than Boston. And they made a pickup, Jaromír Jágr. Now, goodness gracious, they gave up a little bit for him. But this is one heck of a talented player who knows how to win. He has won some Stanley Cups. And I guess he is a right-hand shot on a power play that's loaded with left-hand shots. Why is that important? Well, it's all about the angle of the net and when you're shooting. It's all relative. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're right-handed or left-handed. If you're placed properly to take the shot, if the pass is coming from the right place. Now, we all know that one of the big plays in the league today, and you know, this is something that goes back to the Jari Kurri, Messier, Gretzky era, the cross-ice pass in front of the goaltender, where the goaltender literally has no chance. The only chance he has is a stabbing glove or a quick leg out to stop that cross-ice pass finding that gaping net. So, yeah, Jaromír Jágr is one heck of addition for Boston. So the playoffs this year are going to be really interesting. Who's going to make the playoffs? Well, I'm hoping Winnipeg makes the playoffs. But right now, they've played too many games and don't have enough points, which makes it tough for them to make it. Now, in the West Division, which I, every year in the playoffs, you know, if you don't like the teams that are in the East Division, or if you want to see some really interesting hockey, the best hockey, I think, is played in the West Division. It truly is. And fingers crossed, now they've run into, you know, Edmonton. I'm hoping they make the playoffs. They sneak in, get some experience, because they could very well be the next team that's from Canada that wins the Stanley Cup. I don't mean this as an insult to the Montreal fans or the Toronto fans or any other fans. But, you know, there's a lot more to overcome, even though Montreal's record's very good, and they'll do a good job of proving it. Are they a surprise, Montreal? Will Edmonton be a surprise? Absolutely. But Edmonton right now is a team I'm hoping that, they've got some beautiful players on that team. They've got some wonderful talent. And if only they could get the management team that's right for those players, possibly they will do well. Well, right now they're only 4 points out of the playoffs. And as I said, the longer you're not in the playoffs, the harder it's going to be to make it because the games are running out. We're now ending up in the last 10 block of the season. And in that 10 block, you're lucky if you can make 5 points back. And it's not because a team can't run into a cold spell and lose 4 or 5 in a row. When you're in Edmonton's position and you've got to climb over 3 teams, you got to hope those 3 teams lose 5 in a row. Well, if that's what you're banking on, nothing good's going to happen. So Edmonton, I hope. Calgary? Wow. I guess, was it like about 4 or 5 years ago they were thinking about turfing everyone and starting over, and they made that trade with the Leafs. They sent some young players to Edmonton. Phaneuf came the other way here to Toronto. And their success has been harder to reach than even Toronto's. But Toronto has reached their point of success, which for Toronto fans is just making the playoffs. So that's at least a step in the right direction. Calgary looks like they're in a rebuilding process for sure. But they have a lot of draft picks this year. They have 3 in the first round. So with that, they should be able to, with good drafting, if they really seriously make some good picks. And then the most important part, because good picks are useless if you don't train them well. Well, hopefully they can do something to help train them well. Like in the Canadian Football League, I like the Canadian teams in hockey, and I do have some American teams I like. We'll talk about that later. So Calgary and Edmonton are on the outside looking in as far as the playoffs are concerned. And there sits Vancouver. They're up there hoping to be the first place team. They pretty much are hoping they're too far behind the second seed. They're hoping to stay in the third seed, winning the Northwest Division. Right behind them is Minnesota. As you know, Minnesota is that team that made a couple of really big moves over the summer. And, of course, that became January, the season that is. So, yeah, Vancouver is the class of the Canadian teams historically. I don't think that this year they're as big a threat as Montreal are. They're definitely a bigger threat than Toronto. I'd say they're a 50-50 with Montreal. I'd say they both have the equal chance to make it to the Stanley Cup final. The one thing Vancouver has going for them, and I've watched them in the playoffs every year, and they really are unlucky. The hope this year, if you're a Vancouver Canuck fan, is that they surprise some people. And surprising people is what they're going to have to do. Because, you know, they're going into a hot streak right now. What, 8-2 in their last 10? And, you know, so they're playing the right way at this time of year. They have a lot of experience in playing the big, tough games. So, you know, I would call them a dark horse for the Stanley Cup. I truly would. You know, they got a team in Chicago that they would just love to meet in the playoffs and do in. Another team that has made strides to improvement, Anaheim. They're the second seed and, of course, the first seed in the Pacific Division, which has, of course, the Stanley Cup champions in, the Los Angeles Kings. And they're right behind Chicago, the team that won the Cup before that. And, you know, it's going to be an interesting playoff in the Western Division. For me, the biggest thrill is going to be to see if Detroit makes the playoffs. Now, they've got a 3-point bump on Phoenix. And if they can hang on, this is the most successful team in hockey over the past 25 years. They've been in the playoffs more than anybody else. They've steadily had great winning years, and this is going to be the toughest year for them in the playoffs. You know, they normally as the underdog, but this year they will. So that's my view in hockey this year. Later on, we'll throw some more hockey in a little later, probably Friday. Wednesday after tomorrow, we have, of course, the two college players, and we might get a present-day CFL player. With the luck I've had with CFL players, I'm really not sure. I don't even want to promote it anymore. But having said that, we'll just call it the way things are and leave it at that. Thank you for tuning in tonight. Thank you to Paul Woods, Bouncing Back, the book. He's in the midst of writing it. He's in the midst of still doing interviews about it. And we'll be talking down the road. And for those of you that have been listening, thank you for listening in. We hope you enjoyed what we had to say tonight. And we hope to hear from you at some point or see you next time. Wednesday and Friday, 10 o'clock, Candid Frank Live. Tonight, Monday, 10 o'clock as well. Hope to hear from you soon. Have a great day, everyone. Enjoy the downstretch of the hockey, the beginning of the Blue Jays, disappointing as they are. Give them a chance to gel. The Jays will be a good team. Sports fans, hope you had a good one. Have a good one tomorrow. Take care. Love each other and don't bully. And if you know somebody is, stop them. It's the right thing to do.
The following is a message from the 2012 Grey Cup champions, your Toronto Argonauts. If you didn't hear your voice, there's still time to be a part of next year's crowd. It's okay to pile on. Get your 2013 season tickets today. Call 416-341-ARGO or go to argonauts.ca.
Argo!
Thank you for joining us tonight for the Candid Frank Live Show, heard on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 10:30 to 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Blog Talk Radio. Have a great night, everyone.